You're listening to coverage from the 2008 Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show.
Just west of where it rains and just north of the last UFO sighting in Stephenville, many of you may have heard about. I put up here kind of an outline of what we want to cover today in ranch bovine respiratory disease control, and have that listed here. We're going to review some of the goals and objectives of a BRD control program. I'm going to emphasize the importance of maternal immunity in acquiring these goals. We'll discuss BVD control at the ranch, the importance of early vaccination, some new information about what we can do in vaccinating calves at an early age. We'll talk about pre-weaning vaccinations, weaning vaccinations, and some options for lower-cost weaning programs. So starting with goals and objectives, I think if we look at the goals and objectives of a ranch BRD control program, we can break it up into three key components. Number one is we want to prevent BRD at the ranch level, and usually that's minimal. Many ranches experience no respiratory disease. It's usually after they leave the ranch, but certainly there are situations where that's a problem. We want to be able to meet marketing goals. Certainly there's many vaccination programs, VAC 34, VAC 45, different depending on how cattle are marketed. We want to be able to meet those marketing goals. And then we want to minimize BRD at whatever destination the calves are headed for. I like to think of our approach from a ranch level much like we look at our approach to overall biosecurity, and that's establishing a series of hurdles to bovine respiratory disease. And here I have as the key components of that, or the key categories that we're trying to put up hurdles with, is our maternal immunity, calf vaccination, and stress reduction. Here's some well-conditioned Hereford cows in the Big Bend area of Texas. You can see the Choya cactus in the background, good grass. I don't know if it looks like that now, but a couple years ago they'd had some rains and it looked really good. Dr. Louis Perino, who many of you have heard, he's one of my heroes. He's now an MD. He's no longer working actively in veterinary medicine, but he did some pioneer work with colostrum. Many of you have heard him speak. But this statement, I think, speaks volumes about how we want to manage respiratory disease at the ranch. He says acquisition of maternal immunity is the single most important factor influencing the risk of infectious morbidity and mortality prior to weaning. Now, in addition to that, there's data to show that we can also impact respiratory morbidity and mortality after weaning from good colostral management. And in this study from Whittem and Perino, they showed that cattle were three times more likely to become sick in the feedlot if they had inadequate passive transfer. There are also a number of dairy studies that have looked at long-term effects of inadequate passive transfer. Now, recently I ran across this study. It was published in 1995, but I hadn't seen it before. And basically what they did in this study is they looked at the difference in performance between brown Swiss calves that received either 2 liters or 4 liters of colostrum within the first hour of birth. And what they showed is those calves that just received the 2 liters, their veterinary cost doubled in those calves just from the difference in 2 liters and 4 liters. Those fed 4 liters also gained significantly greater, and they produced over 1,200 pounds of actual milk, more than those given 2 liters. And when you put it to a dollar amount, it represented about $160 per cow difference if the calves received 2 liters versus 4. Now, obviously, that's a dairy study, and you might say, well, what does that have to do with how I manage my cattle operation? I think from a cow-calf perspective, when we're looking at trying to manage colostrum and avoiding inadequate passive transfer, we have to understand what are the risk factors and what are the risk factors that we can modify to decrease the chances of inadequate passive transfer. Such things as dystocia management, culling cows with bad udders, having good nutritional status, good trace mineral status, particularly selenium, copper, zinc. And then finally, there's many things listed here, but vaccination of the dam is an important way to improve colostral quantity and quality, and also hopefully help with decreasing respiratory morbidity and mortality in those calves. Now, this may appear like a stretch, and I'm going to put several slides up that may seem like a stretch, but this is the way I like to think. Could selecting bulls with low birth weight and calving these EPDs decrease respiratory morbidity and mortality? And I think it's easy to make the steps necessary to say, yes, that is a possibility. So when you're making those decisions on the ranch, those decisions that you think are just related to something like having a small calf so you get a live calf, it really is much more than that. And it may impact how well that calf is going to perform for its lifetime. Now, a topic that's been discussed quite a bit recently and that I think is extremely exciting is fetal programming. Just a little brief background on fetal programming. It really started in the 1940s. There was a town in Western Holland that was under blockade from the Germans, and after the war, there was an epidemiological study that was done with women that were pregnant during that blockade time period. And they found that babies that were born to those women had normal birth weights, but when they followed them throughout for a long period after that, they found that there was a much greater degree of obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease. So there were long-term effects with just the nutritional care that the women had during pregnancy. Now, there's been fetal programming studies done with sheep and with swine, and recently there's been some published with cattle. Now, this doesn't relate directly to respiratory morbidity and mortality, but hopefully we'll be able to do some research in the future to see if there even could be a link. But in this study that was published recently, it was in Nebraska, they had cows that were supplemented in the last trimester of pregnancy with 1 pound of 42% crude protein or no supplement. And what they showed that it didn't impact the birth weight of the calves, but the heifer calves born to those cows had heavier weaning weights, had higher reproductive performance, and had less problems at calving. So going back to that relatively simple management input of applying 1 pound of 42% crude protein impacted reproductive performance of those cows, heifer calves. Now, the studies hadn't been done yet to look and see how does that impact respiratory morbidity and mortality. So you may say, why am I throwing this in? Well, I think it all ties in with maternal immunity, maternal health, how we manage that cow herd can have some long-term implications on how calves perform. The Iowa Tri-County Steer Carcass Futurity has collected a lot of data over the years that I think is very valuable. This is some information about the impact of disposition or docility, and they showed that when they group these steers into either docile, restless, or aggressive, there were differences in their performance in terms of average daily gain, the ability to grade. The calm steers were twice as likely to gain CAB status versus aggressive steers. And there was about a $62.19 per head difference in those steers that were calm versus those that were aggressive. If you look at death loss, there was a higher death loss in the aggressive steers as well. Recently, there was a study at Texas A&M, and this was an exceed study where they looked at the impact of exceed on arrival, on respiratory morbidity and mortality, feed intake, and so forth. And there was a surprising finding from that study in that they found that the excitable steers, those that had a high exit velocity, had a much greater response to the antibiotic administration than calm steers. So there was an interaction between temperament and metaphylactic treatment. So apparently there was more, or we think there was probably more respiratory, subclinical respiratory disease in those excitable steers. Recently, the American Angus Association has released docility EPDs. And we know that sire docility heritability is moderate to high, so this is a tool that we can use. And again, this is a management tool. It's not just to have calm cattle, but we know that calm cattle perform better. Calm cattle are less likely to get sick when they leave the ranch as well. I wanted to just say a few things about DVD control, and certainly we've had so many discussions about DVD. I'm sure all of you are very versed in how BVD occurs, but I just wanted to emphasize that if we're going to eradicate BVD, we need to focus on the ranch level. I'm not criticizing the fact that we're testing a lot of cattle after leaving the ranch. Certainly there's some impact there, but we get the most bang for our buck if we can test cattle appropriately at the ranch level. And I think from a BVD standpoint, every ranch should have some kind of a BVD risk analysis. If you have excellent reproductive performance and good records, then there's really no reason to probably worry about doing a lot of testing within your herd. You can use a good pre-breeding respiratory vaccine, as well as with obviously BVD respiratory vaccine, and test new arrivals, and that's probably all you need to do in that particular situation. But if you're having some reduced reproductive performance, then certainly you need to look at either whole herd or selective herd testing for BVD. And the key is protecting that fetus, keeping that heifer or cow immunized with a good vaccination program prior to breeding. In terms of vaccination and preparing the calves prior to leaving the ranch, I want to start first with early vaccination, or what we typically call in the West branding time. This is a time when we can prime those calves and have the opportunity for them to develop a memory response and then respond with a more robust immune response later on. Here we're talking about respiratory viral vaccination with modified live or temperature-sensitive modified live IBR PI3, modified live BRSV, and either modified live or killed BVD with products that are labeled for calves nursing pregnant cows. This is an opportunity to prime the pump, if you will. And when I say early vaccination, I mainly am referring to calves that are older than a week but less than 4 months of age. When I graduated from veterinary school in 1980, we were taught that it really did very little good to vaccinate these young calves with respiratory vaccines due to maternal antibody blockage. Well, the way we were measuring that, though, was simply with the serum antibody titer test, and we won't see serum antibody titer responses necessarily due to maternal antibody blockage, but there's much more to it than that. There's the creation of memory response, there's creation of cell-mediated immunity. So some more recent work over the last 10 to 15 years has shown that early vaccination may very well have value in preventing not only calfhood bovine respiratory disease, but also allow those calves to respond better at weaning. Last fall, at the AABP meeting in Vancouver, Dr. Willems from University of Georgia gave a really good talk on vaccinating calves in the face of maternal antibody, and she reviewed all the literature that was out there and basically came to the conclusion that although you won't see the increase in serum antibody titer, we do show T-cell activation and cell-mediated responses in this priming for memory that I've mentioned earlier. So there is benefit in early vaccinating these calves. Now one issue that you may have heard about is this antigen interference theory that we have, and I think it's more than a theory. There was a paper published out of Canada about 10 years ago, and basically what it showed is that if you give a modified live IBR vaccine and a Mannheimia or Pastorella vaccine at the same time, and it's the first time you've given that Pastorella vaccine, then the body's immune system responds more to the modified live than it does to that Bacterin, and you may not get the immune response to the Bacterin that you'd hope to get. And so one recommendation is to avoid giving a modified live IBR and a Pastorella vaccine, if it's the first time it's done, to avoid doing that the first time. Now, I think this is another good reason why we want to vaccinate these young calves, because if we vaccinate them with a modified live IBR combination product when they're very young, then if we come back and use that pastorella pre-weaning or at weaning, we don't have to worry about this interference issue that may occur. Now, I put a few slides in here on early castration, and I think this has a tremendous impact on respiratory morbidity and mortality after they leave the ranch, so I think it certainly merits talking about here. We know that with early castration, we have improved gains post-weaning, less morbidity, less treatment costs. There's even studies to show higher carcass quality. And I think something that we're all going to have to think about much more in the future is reduced welfare issues that are posed from late castration. There are a lot of people looking at our industry right now, particularly with just what's happened at the slaughter facility in California, and we're going to be under even more scrutiny in the future. And I don't think there's any question that the earlier we can castrate these calves, the easier it is on the animals. Now, there's several studies that document the impact of castration after arrival on morbidity and mortality, primarily from respiratory disease. This study that I'm showing here was a Stocker study, and they showed that there was a 10.3% loss in season-long gain in calves that were castrated on arrival versus calves that arrived as steers. And there was a 60% morbidity rate on the bulls versus 28% on steers. Now, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Jerry Stucka, did this study at Kansas State. It's unpublished, but I know Jerry, and I know the data must be good. But the odds ratio is 2.14, which means that there's over a two times greater likelihood that bull calves would experience respiratory morbidity versus steers. And then some earlier work by Zinn in California showed similar results. Here the morbidity for steers was 26.7% versus 61.8% for bull calves. And then carrying that on beyond a 28-day period, this was a study to close out, and these animals didn't make up for the difference that was lost earlier. There's still a net negative effect of minus 11% of bull calves over steer calves. So I don't think there's any question that we need to castrate steers or bulls as early as possible, and it does have a positive impact on reducing respiratory morbidity and mortality. Now, when is the best time to vaccinate calves prior to leaving the ranch, there's no question that if you can do it 3 to 4 weeks prior to weaning, at that pre-weaning time period, that's the best from an immunologic standpoint. And that's just the basic rule of immunology. We want to try to vaccinate just prior to the maximum exposure that the animals are going to have. And I realize that's a very difficult thing to do in many operations, but I think it certainly has some merit. We need to think about if there's any possible way we can do that in our operations. There's some benefits. Now, over the last 12 to 13 years, Pfizer Animal Health has sponsored a study with Colorado State University and Superior Livestock looking at the price differentials between VAC 34, VAC 45, all the different VAC programs versus non-viral vaccinated calves. And in 2007, we had the highest price differential for VAC 34 we've ever had, $4.68 per hundredweight. That translates to over $26 advantage per calf just for vaccinating those calves one time prior to sale. And there's no weaning involved in this program, just a 3 to 4 week time period that they're vaccinated prior to shipment. And I use some very conservative cost estimates here. Most of you could vaccinate these calves for less than $3, and the labor cost, I put at $2 per head. And even at those very conservative numbers, you're still looking at a greater than 5-to-1 return on investment if you receive that $4.68 per hundredweight premium. Now, there's a new program that's being talked about more, and that's the VAC 34 Plus. And what VAC 34 Plus is, it's basically the same as VAC 34, except there's an additional viral vaccine. You could say calves that were vaccinated early at branding and then vaccinated again 3 to 4 weeks prior to weaning, they would qualify for VAC 34 Plus. We really don't have any good data to show how these cattle are going to perform in relation to VAC 45 or VAC 34 calves, but hopefully over time we'll be able to look at price differentials and look at performance of these calves, and this may be an alternative for people who aren't able to wean. And then the Cadillac program for preparing calves for leaving the ranch is the VAC 45 program. 45-day wean period, two options, either pre-wean wean or wean post-wean, two respiratory virals, a manhymia. Some programs require dewormers, some not. But this is the Cadillac program. I wanted to review the pre-shipment vaccination program data that we collected from Superior over the last 12 years. And I think really when we look at these programs, we need to begin to look at them more as a ticket for market entry, not a premium program, but what do we need to do to play in certain markets. And I think we've definitely moved in that direction. If we look at the data in the Superior sales over the last 12 to 13 years, we can see there's a very positive trend upward for VAC 45, and then, as I showed earlier, VAC 34 really shot up this year as well. Three out of the last 4 years, the VAC 45 calves have brought almost $8 per hundred weight more than calves that were not weaned. And one of the most encouraging pieces of data for me is if we look back at 1995 when the data first began to be collected, almost 50% of the calves in these data sets had not received any viral vaccine. And now in 2006 and 2007, that's less than 3%. So obviously the market has responded. Sellers or buyers are seeing a benefit from these calves, are willing to pay more money for them, and we're seeing sellers are vaccinating their calves. Now, I would explain, this is not all the cattle that are sold in Superior. These are the large sales in the summer, primarily the Ford contract fall delivery large sales. Usually there are 6 to 8 of these per year. And the reason that that's the only data analyzed is those are the only sales where we have enough numbers where we can statistically analyze the different VAC programs. And these years typically recommend typically, these years represent about 400 to 500,000 calves per year. So there's several million calves now in this data set. Now, unfortunately, that's all great that we know we can get better production performance from calves than in a VAC 45 program. But as Dr. Jim McGran states, preconditioning is a marginal business, and added revenue has to be greater than the added cost. And that's been questionable. There's been a lot of argument about that for years, for decades. We've been arguing it does preconditioning pay. Okay, we look at the input costs that we have today: feed costs, fuel costs, labor costs. And I haven't really rerun those budgets or seen budgets in the last few months. But it's going to be even harder to make preconditioning pay, even though we know we get those price premiums are there. But it may not be enough if we don't have a very cost-effective weaning management program. So I wanted to conclude today with just talking about a couple of alternative weaning options that you may want to think about. These are certainly not new, but I wanted to talk about some new data, particularly with dry-lot backgrounding versus pasture. But fence line weaning is something that if you haven't tried, I'd highly recommend you try that. This picture is some early wean calves that I had a couple years ago. It's the first time I tried fence line weaning, and I was very pleased with the results. There's some good data to support that. It reduces stress and can reduce respiratory mortality and morbidity. And as Dr. Ron Gill says, every ranch deserves one good fence, and you can see a picture here of my one good fence. And it was just a 6-strand tight barbed wire fence and had no problems with the calves and cows getting together. As far as fence line weaning data, this is a study that's published in the Journal of Animal Science by Price, and they showed that with fence line weaning, there were decreased vocalizations, increased eating behavior, and less walking activity calves that were fence line weaned versus not fence line weaned. And the bottom line is there was better weight gain when you compare fence line contact with no contact. So in this case, 110 pounds versus at 10 weeks versus 91 pounds with those that had no contact. Now, another alternative to think about with weaning programs is looking at pasture weaning versus dry lot weaning. And Dr. Clay Mathis at New Mexico State University and his colleagues recently did some work. It was a 3-year study looking at the differences between pasture preconditioning and dry lot preconditioning. And here I have the advantages and disadvantages of each program, which they're obvious. One of the concerns about pasture preconditioning is less gain, and you can certainly get better gain with dry lot preconditioning. But with pasture preconditioning, we have less dust, which could contribute to respiratory disease. We have less dietary change. We have less environmental change. Just overall, less stressful way to wean calves. Just to tell you the treatment protocol, this was a 46 to 54 day study. The dry lot preconditioned calves received a preconditioning pellet that was primarily a wheat mid corn based pellet and alfalfa hay. They were fed once a day, and the pasture weaned calves were put on pasture that had been deferred over the summer, and then they were put on it in the fall with a 32% range cube at 1.25 pounds per day, delivered 3 times per week. So it wasn't fed every day. It was just fed 3 times per week like we normally would feed range cubes. So here's the results of that study. And this is a fairly small study, but I think it speaks to some of the alternatives and opportunities that we may have with this type of weaning program. The first 20 days, the pasture calves gain statistically better. And then when you look at the overall 45-day period, as would be expected, the dry lot preconditioned calves gained 1.41 pounds versus 1.10 with the pasture calves. So there was a distinct improvement in gain for the dry lot calves. But when we look at it from a financial standpoint, the net income difference between those pasture weaned calves and the dry lot weaned calves was $44. So even though they didn't perform as well, it was an economic advantage for the pasture calves. And then when they were carried on to the feedlot, overall there was really no difference in gain. But when we look at percent treated and percent that died in the feedlot, there were some significant differences, particularly in death loss. Death loss on those calves that were dry lot backgrounded was 7.6% versus 0 in the pasture. Now, this was a small study, and I'm not suggesting that this would be duplicated and have that kind of a difference in death loss, but there was a difference, and that's what the study showed. The net income difference was $103 per head, and about $70 of that difference was in death loss. But something about the way those calves were weaned and preconditioned on pasture had an impact even into the feedlot. Was it dust? Was it dust in those conditions setting up potential for respiratory disease that was in those cattle and was just still present when they went to the feedlot? I don't know the answer to that, but for whatever reason, pasture preconditioning was a much more economically beneficial alternative. So that's all. All I wanted to discuss today. I just touched on a few things to think about in ranch BRD control, not just the direct inputs that we give to the calf, but how we manage that cow herd may have the most dramatic impact on how our calves perform after they leave the ranch. And certainly we need to look at some alternatives in these times of rising prices with our weaning management programs. So with that, I'll close, and I'll be glad to, how are we doing on time? We have time for a few questions, Bridget? Okay. Yes, sir. Bob.
Bob, Well, somebody in the room may be able to answer this better than I, but from what there's been a lot of studies comparing banding and surgical castration, and it seems, my interpretation is it's almost a wash. Some show benefit one way and some show benefit the other. I think a lot of it, there's a lot of differences in technician. There's technician differences in how they're surgically castrated, so those are hard to evaluate. I don't know. Does somebody in the room may have actually done some of those studies, but I know there's been a number of them done. Some show a benefit to band, and some show a benefit to surgical castration. My personal preference is surgical castration whenever possible. Because you add the expense of the tetanus vaccine that's essential and the expense of the band. But I know there's certainly times with large cutting bullets when banding is good for certain operations. Any other questions? Yes.
Have you seen any difference in the weight gain of calves that have been castrated pre-7 days of age as opposed to calves that are castrated, say, 5 to 6 weeks of age at, say, a branding setting, something like that?
I'm not aware of any differences in, you're referring to, say, the day they're born versus, yeah. I'm not aware of differences. I think even if you did see some differences when you look at the welfare benefits of vaccinating these calves earlier and the reduced respiratory morbidity, I think it would offset any potential you might have for some weight gain, but that's just my personal bias. My personal bias is to castrate calves as early as possible. And I know doing them on, I mean, if you're tagging calves on day one, catching calves and tagging them, to me that's a good time to castrate. And I know there's people that would certainly differ with me on that. Any other questions? Okay, we'll turn it over to the next speaker.
Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Mitch Blanding. He's currently a veterinarian with beef veterinary operations at Pfizer Animal Health. He's a graduate of Kansas State University, and he spent 9 years in private practice. He's been involved in the industry for the past 5 years and is currently living in the Kansas City area. Welcome, Dr. Blanding.
Can you hear me? Okay, ladder back there. Up, turn it up. I'll just hold it. How's that? I'm going to use the little mic. I get kind of claustrophobic when I'm standing behind a podium, so bear with me down here. If I trip over the cord, please don't laugh because I'm kind of sensitive about that. So, and usually when I step up on the podium or step up on the stage, I usually trip up the stairs, so that's not a good thing either. How's everybody this morning? Good? For those of you that aren't from an area where they have gambling, did anybody participate last night? Try their luck? Any winners? Any losers? They didn't build these places on winners, you know that? So, luckily I stayed away. I don't have very good luck at that. So we'll go ahead and get started. I've been asked to talk about prevention and control of respiratory disease, and Dr. Rogers did an excellent job of kind of setting the stage and talking about disease management, particularly respiratory disease management at the ranch. And what I've been asked to talk about is as these cattle move from the ranch and move to the next kind of the next phase that we have in this industry and in the feeder calf portion of the industry, what can we do to impact respiratory disease at that level? And specifically what I'm going to talk about is prevention and control. And what I'm going to talk about within these next 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes, is are there some some goals in the arrival program that we can look at. And I'm going to kind of take a 30,000-foot view of this thing. It's going to be kind of a philosophical-type discussion and talk about strategies more than pure specifics. We're not going to have a lot of product discussion here, and I think we can certainly do that another time. And we welcome you all to stop by, you know, our booth later on. But I'm also going to talk about what we call the BRD triad. And that's specifically prevention, control, and therapy. We'll talk a little bit about that and differentiate between them. And then we'll talk about the benefits of controlling disease, and particularly respiratory disease, the benefits of the operation kind of beyond the cattle itself. So that's kind of the set the stage of what we're going to talk about. So as we look at this, and this is some work that was put together, actually compiled, some data that was compiled by Dr. Calvin Booker and the group that he works with. And they're a veterinary consulting firm out of Canada, consult with a large number of feed yards, both in Canada and the U.S. But this is some of the information put together by the yards that they do some work for. And this is 04 data, and so I apologize for that. I don't have any of the updated data. And I also apologize for those of you clearing the back. You may have difficulty reading this. But basically what this shows is what are the total production costs and taking a 450-pound calf from start or receiving, once we enter in the feeding phase, to slaughter. And I think when you look at it in this way, some of you may be surprised, but obviously the largest production cost associated with that is feed, okay? And you think there's some sensitivity right now to input costs in this industry, okay? Feed, where it's at, record levels, record high levels. What about fuel, okay? So there's quite a bit of sensitivity in the industry right now to input costs. And a lot of that gets expressed in some of these other input costs, like animal health. You can't see that pointer. But if we look at animal health specifically, it's in their data, it's sitting at around 6.3% of total input costs. Okay, so a relatively small chunk of the pie, if you will. They had it about $35 per head, and that includes, you know, processing costs and any medicine costs that goes in associated with treatment of disease, mostly respiratory disease. You can see some of the other costs they accounted for, yardage, interest. They wrapped death loss in there as a separate kind of a category, but it could probably be lumped into animal health as well. Bedding, that's Canadian. They like to utilize the term bedding, and that we kind of lump it into yardage probably more often in the U.S. But as you can see, some of the other input costs make up a relatively small piece of the pie. You could argue right now that with today's record feed costs that blue portion of the pie has probably gotten a little bit larger. Surely on a dollar amount, maybe not so much as a percentage basis, but there's some more dollars involved, particularly in feed costs. So my argument has always been, and I think those of us in the animal health industry has always been, is there something that we can do with that relatively small piece of the pie that we have? Can we make some decisions that's going to impact other parts of our operations, specifically the feed costs? Can we improve efficiency by reducing disease? Can we improve efficiency of the group, make these animals more efficient, and have a greater impact on our feed? Yeah, I think the answer is yes. There's quite a bit of data that would support that. This is kind of the same information, but what they've done here is thrown in the purchase price of the animal. Okay, and you can see if you look at it in that way, you know, our animal health costs are even smaller piece of the pie. And it's a kind of, you know, I know we're always, as I say, we're sensitive to input costs, especially at this particular point in the industry, and we're always looking to, you know, to save a buck here and a buck there, or a penny here and a penny there, depending upon your situation. But I think there's probably certain places we can trim costs, and there's probably certain places where if we evaluate some of these input costs as more of an investment as opposed to just an expense, I think we may be able to do ourselves some favors. The receiving program. The receiving program is kind of like the quarterback of a football team. Probably gets more credit than it deserves when things are going well, and probably gets more blame than it deserves when things aren't going so well. What are the goals of a receiving program? Well, the first thing we'd like to do is be able to reduce sickness, reduce morbidity, minimize the number of animals that actually get sick. And somewhere in there, if we're able to do that, we can probably reduce the ones that die. If we can have fewer animals that get sick, we're probably going to have fewer animals that die. Fewer chronics along with it, because those are the ones that obviously don't respond to therapy very well and they wind up being chronics. Somewhere in there, if we're making the right choices with our animal health program or receiving program, and we're making some sound philosophical decisions and strategies, we're probably going to improve our response to treatment. Doing a better job on the receiving end, certainly on the front end of it, I think sets us up, and the data would suggest sets us up for a better response to treatment down the road when we do actually have to pull and treat some of these animals. And through all that, if we're kind of accomplishing all those things, we're probably going to have improved performance in the group as a whole. Okay, anybody disagree with any of that? It requires a combination of management, nutrition, and animal health products, or animal health specifically. Okay, which is kind of like the three-legged stool. You take one of those away, and it's going to impact the whole operation. All right, they're pretty closely intertwined, if you will. We'd like to talk about there's basically three places to intervene, and I'm talking specifically now about bovine respiratory disease. You basically got three places to intervene. We can intervene with prevention. In other words, so what can we do to prevent an animal from getting sick? All right, there's things that Dr. Rogers just talked about, things that can occur at the ranch of origin that we can employ or utilize, tools that we have available to us that we can utilize to actually reduce disease once these animals get to the next step, feeding phase. Okay? Are there some things that we can do once we receive the animals into the feeding phase? Are there some things we can do? Yeah, absolutely. Okay? But we're trying to prevent disease from occurring. Control is kind of the next step, and it kind of occurs simultaneously. Prevention is applying deworming and vaccination strategies. Control is applying an antibiotic to the group, okay? Oftentimes referred to as metaphylaxis or mass treatment. What we're trying to accomplish there, we've recognized that depending upon the animals that we're dealing with and what occurred at the ranch of origin, and lots of times we don't know that. You know, we receive some animals in the feeding segment of this industry. We oftentimes receive animals that we really don't know any history on them. You know, we don't know where they come from, what sort of management strategies they've had applied at the ranch of origin. And so it's kind of a crapshoot, if you will. We get a set of calves, it's kind of like being dealt a set of cards. We really don't know what we've got until we kind of take a look at them, get into them, and see what we've got. Then once we move on from prevention and control, then we apply therapy. That's the third place to intervene with respiratory disease. These are animals that actually get sick sometime during the early receiving period or any time during the feeding period, for that matter. We actually have to pull and treat. Okay? The most efficient place to intervene is with prevention and control. That's where we get the most return on our investment because we're managing cattle at that point as a group. It's much more efficient, much more effective than managing cattle as individuals. Okay? Once we start pulling and treating individuals, that's when we can start running into problems. It's an inexact science, and we run into some problems by doing that. And generally, when we get to that point, we're behind the eight ball. This is just a graphical depiction of kind of what we're up against when we receive a set of cattle. Right? Animals are at various levels of risk or various classifications of risk. You know, we often refer to animals as high risk, and that's because they've had several stress factors applied to them sometime during the weaning and marketing process, okay? There's been some insult on their immune system. Maybe they're coming from an area that's maybe been under the influence of drought. So maybe we've got drought stress animals coming in that maybe are immunocompromised because of the level of nutrition. Maybe they have trace mineral deficiencies. Who knows? Again, it's kind of like a set of cards. Maybe they went through the marketing channel and have been exposed to significant commingling. All right? The more of these stress factors that we start stacking on these animals, the higher risk they become. So we receive these animals, and that's when we can apply prevention and control strategies during that time, you know, at the initial processing event. Okay, and then once we move out from that and start to begin the early receiving period, that's when we start pulling and treating animals, and then that's when we apply therapy. All right, so just kind of a graphical depiction and trying to differentiate between the three places we can intervene with respiratory disease. Any questions, if any clarifications? I go through this. I mean, it's just a large group, and I apologize. It's such a deep room, or else I'd have made my slides a little larger. So if you need some clarification back there, please raise your hand, and I'll do what I can. Okay, prevention specifically. And the best place to intervene here is back at the ranch, okay, what Dr. Rogers just talked about. Anything that we can do at the ranch of origin to better prepare these animals for the next phase in the industry is a good thing. Okay, even if we do minimal, it's still better than nothing. Unfortunately, a lot of animals that we receive as part of the feeding industry, a lot of these animals have had virtually nothing, okay, and been exposed to a lot of these stress factors. Things like vaccination and deworming, that's really what we're trying to accomplish when we talk about prevention, at least when we get our hands on these animals. We're trying to enhance the overall immunity level of the group. If we increase the number of protected individuals or number of immune individuals within a group, we actually decrease the risk of that group of animals getting sick. Okay, that's really what we're trying to accomplish. Now, some groups, obviously, you know, each group is going to be different, and we're going to have better luck with that than with other groups. But that's what the goal is. And again, I mentioned this. This is the highest return on investment right here. If we can intervene with prevention, okay, keep these animals from actually getting sick. There's a couple of classifications of the immune system. I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but just kind of make sure we're all on the same page. There's what we call innate or natural immunity, all right? That's kind of the body's own self-defense mechanism. Skin would be an example. Any sort of a barrier to infection, okay? The skin provides a barrier to infection to the pathogens that may be that these animals are exposed to or that we're exposed to on a daily basis. Things like mucus, the mucociliary escalator. Throughout the day, you're always clearing your throat. There's lots of mucus produced along your respiratory tract that helps to trap some of these pathogens that we're exposed to on a daily basis. Well, same thing in cattle. And when we expose these animals to things like transportation, throw these animals on a truck for 18, 20, 24 hours, we dehydrate these animals and we have an impact on the mucociliary escalator. I liken it to if you fall asleep and sleep with your mouth open at night, you wake up and your mouth's pretty dry and throat's dry and coughing and hacking the next day for several hours until you kind of rehydrate yourself. Same thing happens here, and it makes these animals much more susceptible to some of these pathogens that they're exposed to getting down to the lower respiratory tract or the lungs where they can cause problems. It's heavily influenced by management. Okay, there's nothing that we can give these animals beyond management and husbandry. There's no magic vaccine or shot that we can give these animals to actually impact innate immunity. It's all a result of management. The adaptive or acquired immune classification is actually what we're trying to accomplish when we give these animals vaccines. We're trying to train the immune system. The immune system develops as or responds as a result of what we're giving them, either as a result of a vaccine or actually as a result of natural exposure as well. It's kind of a learned part of the immune system. Whenever I talk about immunity, I always like to point out that with any given group, there's going to be limitations on the number of animals that are actually going to respond. Okay? So what do we do when we vaccinate an animal? The only thing that we've really ensured is we've stuck a needle in them or stuck something up their nose and exposed these animals to the vaccine, right? What's the next step? The animal actually has to respond to that vaccine. I'm going to ask a question here, and it's kind of maybe kind of an arbitrary question, but in a typical high-risk set of calves, there is no such thing as a typical high-risk set of calves, okay? But in general terms, what percentage of those animals do you think, when they come off the truck and you allow them to get a drink of water and maybe grab a bite of hay or feed, when you run through the chute and process them, what percentage of those animals do you think are capable of responding to a vaccine? 50%? 60%? 70? Less than 50? Any takers? I don't know. Okay, but it's less than if we walk a set of mature cows out of the pasture, walk them through the chute, and vaccinate them pre-breed. Okay? It's going to be significantly less, I think. I think the data would support that. So we've got a pretty potentially a significant number of animals that won't even respond to a vaccine. Okay, so we're behind the eight ball in terms of prevention already. And then let's say we've got some of those animals actually respond to the vaccine. The level to which they respond and are actually protected is going to be highly variable as well. Okay, if we've got a level of protection at here and we have exposure at here, these animals are still at risk. Okay, still at risk of getting sick, still at risk of breaking down whatever prevention strategies we may be trying to employ. Okay, let's talk a little bit about control. okay? As I mentioned, control is applying an antibiotic to the group. And generally speaking, we're talking about an injectable antibiotic. Now, I realize there's things that you can put in the feed or antibiotics that you can put in the feed. We're going to kind of limit our discussion to the injectable products that are available. And if you look at the label, there's about six products that are approved for what we call the control and treatment of respiratory disease, bovine respiratory disease. Control, as I said, mentioned, refers to applying antibiotic for the control of bovine respiratory disease and cattle at high risk of developing respiratory disease. You look at the label and that's what it will say. Associated with, and it will list the pathogens, and that will vary depending upon the product that you're using. But the FDA doesn't like the term, or doesn't care for the terms metaphylaxis or mass treatment. They kind of have a negative connotation, if you will. So the FDA recognizes control. So if you look at that bottle of antibiotic, it'll say for the control of respiratory disease, and that's what we're referring to, what we call metaphylaxis or mass treatment. Okay, what's the primary reason you might select a control antibiotic? Okay? Part of our group, I'm with Veterinary Operations, Pfizer Animal Health, and in our group we got a new tool to play with last summer. It's called an audience response system, and unfortunately we didn't have it available to use at this meeting, partially because of the size of the group. But what it allows you to do is I can hand out a remote to each of you, and I can ask you a question here on the screen, and you can have the opportunity to answer it. Some of you may have utilized some of this technology. But this is one of the questions I like to ask, okay? You're applying an antibiotic to a set of calves that are coming in as part of a control. What are you really trying to accomplish? And I kind of hold you to select one answer. You might read through these and say, well, it's all of the above. Okay, but I kind of pin you down to one answer. How many think the biggest benefit is reduction in number of pulls? Okay, got a few takers, all right? And there's a significant amount of data that supports that. Yeah, we do have a reduction in morbidity when we apply a control antibiotic to a set of high-risk calves. Okay, reduction in the number of deaths. Reduced number of dead cattle. Okay, a few takers. All right. And again, the list of studies that have been done to support that is pretty lengthy. I haven't bothered to reference them all. Improved performance during the receiving and feeding period. Any takers there? Okay. Some more? Actually, that's fairly significant. One in the back there. Thanks for speaking up. Okay, how about operational efficiency? All right, excellent. A few takers on that. I think the second two is really where the opportunity lies, the bottom two, excuse me. Improving performance and improving operational efficiency. I'm going to kind of describe what I mean. I know what I was going to point out here. When I first started widely using a control antibiotic in some of the clients that started high-risk cattle, you know, one of the big selling points was it was going to reduce the number of pulls, reduce total morbidity, and it does. But you start thinking about that, when you apply an antibiotic to the whole group, you've already started out with 100% morbidity, haven't you? Okay? So how many fewer do you have to pull before you really pay for it just in reduction of sickness? So if you had a group that you thought you were going to probably anticipate pulling 60% of them, and you applied an antibiotic and treated them all, and then you only pulled 20%, is that really an advantage? So we're looking at 120% morbidity versus 60% morbidity, right? Have you ever followed that logic? So the real benefit of that has to come from the bottom two, right? Improving performance and reducing the number of deaths, improving operational efficiency. Okay, what is the dollar impact of respiratory disease? A lot of studies done look at this, and we just kind of show some of the most common. The Texas Ranch to Rail studies would obviously illustrate there's a significant advantage to animals not getting sick during the feeding period. Their studies over an 8-year period were about $87 or nearly $90 per head for those animals that did not get sick. Dr. Fulton at Oklahoma State has done some work that would demonstrate we treat an animal one time, costs us about $40. We treat an animal twice, we get up into that $60 range. We treat animals three or more times, they really get in our pocket. Why is that? Well, typically these ones that we treat multiple times are the ones that are going to die or wind up as chronics, and so those are the ones that really become expensive. Generally speaking, we treat an animal once and he responds and you know, returns to normal, supposedly, responds to initial therapy. Generally speaking, performance isn't as effective as those animals that don't respond to the initial therapy. The iceberg concept. This is why we really, truly apply a control antibiotic. Because there's only going to be a certain number of animals that we can actually detect illness in. Okay, and detection of illness, as you all know, is an imprecise science. Okay, it's an extremely difficult thing to do. In certain groups, it's more difficult to do than in others. Okay. But we can see some animals that we actually can assess are clinically affected. Those are the ones that are obviously sick. However, there's going to be a certain percentage, and depending upon the risk classification of the group, there may be some that are subclinically affected, okay, ones that are kind of smoldering, if you will. They're sick, but they may not be as easily recognizable as some of the others, right? And this is one of the real benefits with applying a control antibiotic to that group is we can impact those animals there, the ones that aren't clinically apparent. Been a couple studies done to demonstrate this. Dr. Whittem in 1996 did a study where they followed cattle from when they were received into the feed yard all the way to slaughter. Okay, they tracked data, feeding data, and then followed these animals to slaughter and looked at lung lesions. Okay, as these animals were going through the harvest process, if you will. These cattle were handled as you would typically expect a set of feeder cattle to be handled once they arrived at the feed yard. For this group, they pulled 35% of those calves. Okay, through the entire feeding period, 35% of those animals got sick, were pulled and treated. At slaughter, they found lung lesions in 78% of the cattle. All right, they only treated 35%, they found lesions in 78% of the cattle. 72% of all the cattle had lung lesions. 78% of the 35% that were actually treated had lung lesions. Okay? 68% of untreated steers had lesions. So the bottom line is that, again, pulling sick cattle, recognizing sick cattle is an imprecise science. Probably the bottom line is we're treating cattle that don't need to be treated, and we're missing cattle that do need to be treated. Right? And one of the benefits of a control antibiotic is to help eliminate some of those animals that aren't clinically apparent to us in terms of when we go to pull and treat sick animals and apply therapy to them. In this particular study, the difference between those animals that had a lung lesion at slaughter and those that didn't was 46 pounds of gain throughout the feeding period. Okay, so pretty significant difference. Another similar study done by Dr. Gardner at Oklahoma State where they treated 50% of the group throughout the feeding period. 68% of all the steers had lesions, okay? So there are 18% in there that they missed. 48% of the treated steers had lung lesions at slaughter. So they, of the ones that they treated, they guessed right on about half of them. Half of them had lung lesions, half of them didn't, okay? So we're treating some animals that probably don't need to be treated. We're probably treating a lot of GI-type issues as respiratory disease, applying an antibiotic to them, and they don't respond very well. 38% of the steers never pulled also had lung lesions. So again, the bottom line, we're missing cattle that need to be treated, and we're treating cattle that probably don't need to be treated. It's an imprecise science. Some of his conclusions were, cattle recovering from BRD never compensated for lost performance. And I think that's true, and I think we probably know that. The fact that 52% of the cattle treated for respiratory disease had no lung lesions. Again, this imprecise clinical diagnosis and imprecise clinical science. This strengthened the argument for mass medication at that time. Those are the terms they used. We now know it today as control. What about operational efficiency? You remember that fourth bullet point? Operational efficiency. And the best way I can sum this up, if respiratory disease or sickness in your feeder cattle operation is acting as a bottleneck, okay, if health in your operation is a bottleneck, then that's impacting your operational efficiency. If it prevents you from taking advantage of buying and marketing opportunities, maybe the market has presented you an opportunity to lay in a bunch of calves that you can lock in and make some money, okay? Laying in a set of profitable calves, but yet you're scared of health or scared of what health challenges will present, is that impacting your operational efficiency? Yeah, it is. If you're out there spending a lot of time treating sick cattle in any given group, and it's consuming a lot of time, is that pulling time away from other things in the operation that you could be doing, if not generating income, but helping to make you more profitable in other areas of the operation? Yeah, absolutely, I think it is. And that's one of the real advantages, I think, to appropriately applying control antibiotics in certain situations. Beyond the cattle, one of the the most common comments that we get anymore from folks that are utilizing appropriate control strategies are that, you know, my quality of life is much better. I think it's improved my outlook on my operation. I now have a weekend. Okay, I now have some time to spend with my family. I spend less time treating and retreating sick cattle. I don't know. It's just a, it's really actually a quality of life issue. Some folks will say it's like, you know, this product, whichever one it is that I choose to use and use it effectively, it's like having another person. Okay, it's reduced the need for labor. And as we all know, labor in this segment of the industry has become pretty tight. One of our veterinarians, actually one of our customers who's a veterinarian in central Missouri, shared some of this information with me a couple years ago, and I'd like to kind of use it, and it kind of summarizes what we've all talked, what we've just been talking about. But he compared an operation that was not using a control antibiotic previously, and then they started using a control antibiotic, and he took a snapshot of the operation prior to and after starting using a control antibiotic. And what these charts are representing is morbidity or pull rate prior to and after utilizing a control antibiotic. The top is prior to a control antibiotic. And you can see morbidity differences between the groups. Okay, you had a set of, you had a group occasionally that really fall apart in there, 30 to 40% morbidity. Then you'd have a group that, you know, did pretty well. Maybe you only pulled 10 to 15% of the group. But there was a huge variability between groups of cattle, which there is anyway. Okay, we all know that. There's going to be huge variability anyway. But it was really dramatic prior to using a control antibiotic. When they applied a control antibiotic, you can see the variability decreased a little bit. We still had some pretty substantial variability, which, you know, we're not going to avoid. But what in his mind, in this owner's mind, what it allowed them to do was apply some sort of consistency and predictability to any set of cattle, any given set of cattle. We had fewer swings in terms of what, how health was going to impact us in those particular groups. It wasn't maybe, if you look at it on an average basis, maybe not what you would expect to be a huge difference in actual average morbidity between the two scenarios, but the difference was in consistency and predictability. The other thing that allowed these folks to do as a result of that was they moved from 1,500 to 2,200 head that they moved through their operation on an annual basis. No real improvement in terms of, they didn't increase the number of either the land they had available or the number of pens that they had available to start cattle in, but they were able to move cattle more efficiently through their operation because they had less issues with health, and so they were actually able to move more animals through their operation and become more efficient as a whole. So in conclusion, treatment programs are great, and Dr. Applin is going to talk about that, and there are some actually things that we can do in terms of our treatment programs to evaluate or to apply to have a tremendous impact on our treatment success. They're critical parts of our operation. But we're, as I mentioned earlier, that's probably the most inefficient place to apply some sort of BRD intervention. Things that we can do prior to that in terms of procurement, you know, what types of cattle we're buying, whether it's preconditioned cattle or really high-risk cattle, you know, that may be a prevention strategy that you want to apply. Maybe there are certain times of the year or certain the market may be presenting you an opportunity to lay in cattle that are preconditioned and are going to have less health issues if that fits into your operation. But this is really where we can have an impact on efficiency and profitability. Excuse me, predictability. I'm always a big believer in consistent protocols. Okay, if I don't get anything else across to you today, I would encourage you to apply consistent protocols across your operation, whether it's feeding, your animal health selection, you know, anything that you're going to do or apply to your operation, consistency is key. It's very difficult to go in and evaluate what's going on in an operation when there's no consistency. One of the questions that I ask with our audience response system, what's the most consistent input into your operation? Feed, cattle, weather, animal health products. Our animal health products, I think, are an opportunity for us to improve our consistency. Okay, improve the consistency we can apply at least to our protocols. And I need to throw in here the responsible and appropriate use, judicious use of antibiotics. You know, I've talked about applying a control antibiotic. There are certain groups of cattle that probably don't need a control antibiotic, and I think we all understand that. And obviously the society we live in today is very sensitive toward the appropriate use of antibiotics. But I think in certain situations and certain sets of calves, applying a control antibiotic is a judicious use of antibiotic in terms of reduction in animal suffering and improvement in animal performance. And then finally, measure and manage. Okay? If there's anything else you can do besides applying consistent protocols, measure what you're doing and manage it based upon the measurements that you're taking. I think those are tremendous steps that we can take, at least in this segment of the industry, to improve our results. So with that, that's all I had. Are there any questions real quickly? Must have been everybody asleep or confused everybody. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Our last speaker for this session is Dr. Mike Apley. He's a Kansas State veterinarian. He spent time in general and feedlot consulting practices. He has his PhD in board certification in clinical pharmacology. He's a past president for the Academy of Veterinary Consultants, and he's current president of the American College of Veterinary Clinical Pharmacology. He's also part of the Beef Production Medicine Group at Kansas State University. Welcome, Dr. Apley.
Good morning. We'll follow up those two talks that really did a nice job of setting the stage for a place we hope we don't get to, and that's therapy in beef cattle. Now, I'm going to go over a few things that I've picked up in a career of struggling with exactly how to do this. But first, I'd like to bring you greetings from the Beef Production Medicine Group at Kansas State University. You probably recognize a few of the characters in that picture. We're having a good time trying to figure a few things out there. I think there's some basics of therapy, and Dr. Blanding did a nice job of going through some basic components, and I think there's five basic components of therapy that if you leave any of them out of your system, you might as well just hang it up. First one is characterizing your disease challenge. We've really got to understand what our true disease challenge is, and we're going to talk about some treatment outcomes, but you also have to look at what your true morbidity challenge is and the true causes of those morbidity. And there's some things, when it gets to the stage of being a chronic respiratory, other than what's present at the time that it succumbs to the disease, we're pretty sure respiratory is the problem. But you can get into some other interesting things challenging your operation, and without some work on that, you might come up short in actually realizing what it is. The other thing is taking the time to develop case definitions for when you will define therapy. And that sounds kind of academic at the output, but I've been in too many places that were floundering with their therapy programs, and part of the reason is they couldn't really agree on what to treat. You'd have huge discrepancies on someone treating over a weekend versus during the week, different people, what they're pulling and treating, and it made it very hard to evaluate the program. The third thing is regimen design, and that's one of the things we often want to cut to: what drug, how much, how often. What's the secret formula? What's the secret recipe? And we'll come back to that in a minute. Regimen design is very, very important. We'll talk about a few of the very important inclusions in that. But first, you have to agree on what you're going to treat. Mitch mentioned consistent application of protocols, and that's one of my main messages also. Too many times we get that animal in the chute and we say, I think we ought to use this. I had a feedlot manager once tell me he could look that critter in the eye at the chute and tell whether it needed Thailand or spec. And what do you say other than that's impressive? You know, we didn't exactly hit it off. And then outcome evaluation. You've got to go back and evaluate what happened. But the only time outcome evaluation matters is if you did something consistently. If you're not willing to invest the time to do something consistently, for heaven's sake, don't waste your time keeping records, and don't waste your time trying to evaluate records if you're not going to do it consistently. It's a combination of the hand you're dealt and how you play it. And we just listened to ways that you can have an impact on the hands you're dealt, on the demands you place on the cattle you buy, on how you raise your own cattle, and then what you deliver to the customer, who then realizes you're a source for delivering what they expect. I don't know any secret combinations or regimens. I run into a lot of people that do, and they're con artists. And you can tell them I said that. If they've got some secret recipe or combination, you're dealing with a con artist. The other day I got a call from a veterinarian who's a client received a group of cattle that the secret recipe was long-acting penicillin and dexamethasone pre-treatment and then a couple more times on arrival. Okay, hopefully everyone in this room is beyond that. If you're putting dexamethasone in sick cattle, we've got a real problem. Okay, hopefully we're beyond that. And that's one of the things I do know that can be adverse or make a difference. And when I say dexamethasone in sick cattle, I'm talking about respiratory disease cattle, either for prevention or for treatment. Okay? There's things we know that can cause a harm. Dexamethasone is used as a research model to stop neutrophil function of the white cells in cattle. Okay? It's used as a research model for that. So what happens in treatment? Drug and the diseased animal are combined. Okay? And there's a black box that happens, and then there's outcome. So we get wondering, what in the world happens inside that black box? There's a lot of things. Being a pharmacologist, I looked at PK down there, pharmacokinetics, how the drug moves. There's nutrition, the regimen, pathogens, stage of disease it's interacted with, their immune status, whether we have the right diagnosis. PD is pharmacodynamics, how the drug interacts with it, right? All these things go into that black box. And our tendency is to do one or two things to that black box. And then if that outcome changes on the right side, we assume that that outcome difference is due to whatever we did to that black box. Well, in matter of fact, when we do something and then look at the next year or the next pin of cattle, a lot of other things happen in that black box. And we have to be careful that we don't put all of the difference that occurred on the little change we made. Huge differences can happen pin to pin, year to year, month to month. You all know that. Okay? We all know that in here. So that's why today I'm going to make some references to trials. What I've struggled to find in a prospective, randomized clinical trial that would be our highest level of evidence. So first, in characterizing disease, why is the animal sick? That's the case definitions I talked about. That's making sure that our application of treatment is going to an animal that's being treated for what we think it's being treated for. And that may require an investment in diagnostic tests, postmortem exams. And a lot of times we say, man, a postmortem exam, that animal's already dead. But it can be a very useful tool in helping you realize what you're actually treating. Be very valuable. Case definition again. There's a term, that case definition. One of the benefits of case definitions is when you train new people, think about how easy it would be if you said, this is what we look at for treating an animal. This is what we actually look at. And that characterizing disease also implies you know how it's spread, how it affects animals, so you can plan your prevention and management of sick animals. So let's look at an example of a case definition for respiratory disease. You need to go through and characterize these as important or misleading criteria. And one of the things I encourage you to do is find a veterinarian that wants to be involved in this with you. We all go to different meetings. We all have different life experiences. We're all learning in different segments. And putting that together on your team is a tremendous asset for you. So do you consider depression, nasal discharge, ocular discharge, rumen fill or appetite, rectal temperature, or lung sounds? All those possible things you could put together to try to have a diagnosis. This calf has a nice set of nose boogers here. Some of you may put different emphasis on nose. When it gets really thick and ropey, I get pretty concerned with them. This heifer was in a study where we actually put in implanted temperature transmitters, and we found if they had a real thick, ropey discharge, they were more likely to have an elevated temperature over their pin mates, but it didn't necessarily put them over 104 or something like that. But they could have an elevated temperature. rumen fill, I always have that attract me to an animal, but I don't let a full rumen talk me out of pulling an animal. We're doing some more work again on actually listening to the lungs in high volume cases in feedlots and finding out it can help us quite a little bit. A lot of us might just combine a depression and a thermometer. But we're going to talk about evaluating your treatment outcome in a little bit. And you can use those evaluations of a consistently applied case definition to start saying, wow, am I missing some? Or should I be digging a little deeper in them? So here's the regimen design thing. And this is where we all want to believe that there's a certain regimen out there that will take a very poor hand we were dealt and turn it into a straight flush. Okay. I went back to grad school to find that, and I haven't been successful. And it's led me to the conclusion that maybe others haven't either, other than finding reasonable drugs that we apply in the best possible manner. So this regimen includes the drug, the dose, the route, and this is where we keep beef quality assurance foremost in our minds for the healthy and wholesome product we produce in this organization. When we start planning how and where we're going to give these products, our duration is becoming even more important. We have products now that you may have a post-treatment duration of 10 to 14 days before you would consider those animals for further treatment. It is incredibly important that you're well aware of those post-treatment intervals and that you institute a system that the minute they are eligible for further therapy, they are evaluated for further therapy. Too often we get a little casual about that, and then we have an animal out there that dies of neglect rather than lack of therapy because its therapy expired, it needed more therapy, and we lose track of which ones are ready to go on to more therapy. So put that in your protocol, how you're going to track those animals. I was at a feedlot recently with the long post-treatment interval drugs where they actually took little fairly sturdy cards, cut out a chunk, wrote the date they were eligible for further therapy, and tag glued it to their forehead. You may use chalk, but some kind of system where when you look at that animal, someone out in the pen can look at that animal and go, it looks kind of punk, but it's got one more day before we'd repull it and treat it. Or it looks punk, and it's eligible now, out it comes. That's very important. And, of course, the slaughter withdrawal and frequency of administration. So the whole thing was on the title slide, just planning your work and working your plan. And so often it happens to us when we get into an outbreak, things aren't going the way we want them to, and we start reaching and grabbing and switching. And I cannot think of a time where in the middle of a serious wreck, it was turned around because we swapped to another drug. I can tell you what I have seen happen is drugs were given the credit for turning a wreck around. But when you listen to this, you'll all realize you already knew it. When you get in a group of high-risk calves and they shell on you right away, those calves you treat in the first 3 or 4 days, what do you think the case fatality rate will be, which is the number that die out of the number you treated? What will you think that case fatality rate will be versus the ones you treat the second week? Think it'll be higher or lower? Everyone thinks it's higher. Right. Why is it higher? Those calves are further along in the disease process. They're displaying the signs to you while they're in the highest stress period on arrival. So do you think the drug that's used to treat those calves in those first 3 or 4 days is going to look like it does better or worse than a drug you panic and switch to after 5 or 6 days? It's going to look worse. So there's a whole group of high-efficacy first-line antibiotics out there we can choose from. To think that switching between those in a group of those calves made the difference, but yet we'll think it did because we go back and, well, I switched to that second drug, they stopped dying. Be careful you're comparing apples to apples. And that's why I always go back to controlled studies. And again, stay consistent through the fog times, the fog of a wreck. Things get crazy in the middle of that. You've got calves, you're treating, you're tired. Plan that ahead of time and stick with that protocol. So again, a good protocol, and in your handout, there's a sample protocol you can look at. Doesn't mean that's the way you have to build it, but it's got a lot of stuff included in it. You've got to have that case definition. And you may not agree with my case definition. I may not agree with yours. That's fine. There's a lot of good ones at work. But the important thing is you have one. Your initial therapy regimen, dose, route, duration, frequency, post-treatment interval, slaughter withdrawal. Then case definition for success or failure, and then what happens if they're a success or a failure? Does that animal have to have a normal temperature for me to call it a treatment success? What I've figured out is if that animal looks normal at the end of the post-treatment interval, I don't want to know what its fever is. A lot of those things will carry a temp and go out and do fine. And with the experience you have, you can say that animal's recovered, it's eating, it's drinking, it's bright and alert. Some of those have a fever for a while longer. Save your drugs for the ones that need it. And then what happens with ones that are a treatment failure? What do I do the next time? So now let's talk just a little bit about how we'd evaluate outcomes. There's what we hope to get, and that's a first treatment success. That's an animal that was not treated again after the first treatment regimen. It was not treated again. A chronic, that's one that has not responded to the complete treatment regimen. Okay? And I have a hard time thinking that three treatment regimens, more than three for a respiratory disease case, does as much of any good. Some of those long post-treatment interval drugs, maybe two is all you need. Two total ones. We do expect our chronics to always be equal to or at least half of our deads. So when we count up our mortality number, we always expect our chronics to be half or equal to that. And I always chill when I hear of high mortality incidents because I know that they've got non-performing animals rather than the ones that, you know, maybe lose a couple tenths of a pound a day, but there's a lot of them in there that are really seriously hurt. Treatment failures are the ones that are treated again immediately following the end of that post-treatment interval. Then retreats or relapses, we use 21 days. They get out there. They've been a treatment success for 3 or 4 weeks. And then they come back and are treated again. And we argue about, well, is it a continuation or a new one? We're not sure, but we tend to use 21 days as the break of saying it's a relapse or after 21, it's a new episode. And you can keep track of those numbers. If you evaluate your case fatality rate, right? Your case fatality rate, again, is dividing the number that died by the number that were treated. And for respiratory disease and some of these calves the ones Mitch and Glenn talked about that come off a ranch that they've been well prepped, they've been weaned, they've been vaccinated, they're ready to go, their bunk broke, the stress is low, we expect to see 1-2% of the low number treated that die. When you get in the ones that are done the opposite side of the coin, everything wrong, we can see as 10% or more of the ones that are treated that become mortalities with an almost equal set of chronics. It's very important you understand the expected case fatality rate for the type of cattle you are dealing with, and then you keep track of your case fatality rate. Look back at that. If you're running a 15% case fatality rate in pre-vaccinated, weaned, low-risk, short-haul calves, something's wrong. We're getting to them too late, or something's wrong. Now, the thing you compare that with is morbidity, which is the percent you treat. We'd hope to have 5% or less morbidity. The very first thing to figure out when you're in a wreck is it a morbidity problem or is it a case fatality problem? Do I have cattle that have died because they didn't respond to treatment or because I treated a whole lot and the treatment response was acceptable? If the answer is I treated a whole lot of cattle and the treatment response was acceptable, obviously switching drugs or adding drugs is not going to make a difference, yet that's the knee-jerk reaction in a lot of breaks. So, first question, is this a morbidity or a case fatality problem? Let your head get clear. You sit down and look at those numbers and you can start driving your way out of it. Here's a basic treatment record. A lot of times, the electronic treatment records, unless there's some that are really targeting this application, can be kind of pricey. for some of the producers in the feeding 1,000 or 2,000 head a year, or smaller. Maybe you feed a couple hundred, or you're trying to keep track of health in your calves. There's some out there that can help you. There's nothing wrong with a basic treatment record like this that just lets you follow through and see what's happened with the cow. So one of the other things I've mentioned in your handout is that we should keep several things in mind. We've already mentioned the beef quality assurance guidelines. The American Association of Bovine Practitioners have put out a set of judicious antimicrobial use principles that have been endorsed and are also put out by the American Veterinary Medical Association. And the other thing is the Animal Medicinal Drug Use Clarification Act, or AMDUCA regulations. And all those you can Google on the web and find. The AMDUCA regs talk specifically about what's required, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. So I'm going to take a few excerpts out of those judicious antimicrobial use guidelines, and an antimicrobial is a specific name for some of the antibiotics. And let's go through them on what they say, and then I'll give you what I think they mean for us as we start looking at these programs. The first one is select and use antibiotics carefully. Consult with your veterinarian on the selection and use of antibiotics. Have a valid reason to use an antibiotic. And therapeutic alternatives should be considered prior to using antimicrobial therapy. When you get into calf scours now, I think everyone in here realizes that fluids and addressing acidosis in those calves is more important for most of the causes of calf scours than is an antibiotic. So there's other therapies that need to be in there along with or instead of, in some cases, an antibiotic. So my interpretation is don't just throw antibiotics at cattle. Get more information than just from the coffee shop, feed store, or the route truck. You've got to really consider the post-treatment interval. You've got to consider the label applications of these drugs, and then pick one and go with it. Combination antibiotic therapy is discouraged unless there's clear evidence this practice is beneficial. Okay, now this is like jumping up in a bar and say, anyone who drives a Ford's an idiot, and then fight your way to the door, right? Pick your brand, okay, Dodge. The take-home from this is there is no evidence out there that using more than one antibiotic at a time is beneficial in cattle. For BRD, for foot rot, for calf scours when it's indicated, for pink eye, I have not been able to come across any study that demonstrates that adding an antibiotic in the diseases you treat helps you. I know one thing it does. It increases the cost. It increases sites of administration in the animal. It increases the time you take to treat the animal. Okay, I'm still looking for a good thing in there. Not coming up with it. So if you want to break free and use one antibiotic at a time, feel free. And sometimes we think, oh, with these long-acting drugs, we've got to get something in an IV that works real quick. Those drugs are maxed out by 12 hours at the latest, a lot of them within 4 to 5 hours, some of them within 2. If we're to the point where we've pulled that animal late enough, we think we need an IV drug to save it, you can tell me what the problem is there. And it's not that single injection antibiotics taking too long to get to concentration. Mitch talked about quality of life. One way to help your quality of life is to spend less time putting things in them as they come through the chute. Treatment programs should reflect best use principles. Regimens for therapeutic antimicrobial use should be optimized using current pharmacological information and principles. This requires planning, especially means planning your post-treatment intervals again. If you're not familiar with that term, I'm sure many of you are, you should leave here saying, man, I've got to make sure I understand the best post-treatment interval and then what I do at the end of that post-treatment interval. And that requires a case definition for success-failure and then a plan for what you're going to do with the successes and what you do with the failures. There's dose selections within flexible labels. Some of the drugs have different choices for post-treatment intervals. I'd suggest working with your veterinarian and challenging your veterinarian on exactly what you want to know. I need to know this information. Here's a little bonus piece of information. When you get home, I want you to go out to the shelf where you keep your drugs. And I want you to pretend you're getting ready for a respiratory outbreak, which hopefully you're going to prevent. And I want you to shuffle the antibiotics to one side of the shelf. And then I want you to take everything else you put with an antibiotic for respiratory disease, and I want you to make a little break there, and I want you to shuffle the other to the other side of the shelf. Now look at that pile of stuff you give with an antibiotic for respiratory disease. Okay? Make a sign that goes there and put waste of money on that part of the shelf and label it so we're all comfortable with what we're doing when we're picking something off that shelf. There are no data that I'm aware of that indicates a performance benefit or a treatment response benefit for anything we give other than an antibiotic for respiratory disease therapy. I'll repeat that. There are no data to support that anything we give other than an antibiotic makes a difference in response to respiratory disease therapy. Ask the people that recommend them to you, where is their data? Ask them for all the data they have run. Okay. So that's the one take home I'd like to see you have. One of a few, I say that a lot. Treat the fewest number of animals possible. Limit the antibiotic use to sick or at-risk animals. Think about the disease presentation that will cause you to put antibiotics in cattle. The thing I would love to see is some of the people that hammer on us about our use of drugs, I'd love them to run into you guys and you say, well, here's our case definition for when we use them. I don't know how you argue with that. I don't know how that does not meet the definition of judicious use. And decide when you're going to quit. One of the biggest lessons I learned in my days in the feedlot was that when we treat them for so long, we need to stop. And I'm convinced we can make chronics by treating them too long. There comes a time when we need to let them go. Treat them humanely. If euthanasia is required, do that. Give them good feed, good water, shelter, a clean environment, and support them and euthanize them if they're suffering. Again, duration of therapy, post-treatment intervals. I've beaten on this over and over. It's one of the most important things you can know is exactly when to go again. Keep your records. Simple records. This is an example of inadequate treatment records. It has not been proven that compounds in chalk improves treatment response. I know I'm hurting you here, but the contents in chalk are not therapeutic. This chalk mark meant Grandma treated it on Sunday with her favorite drug and Cousin Floyd caught it again Tuesday but didn't treat it. That's that decoding of that one. And the next week it meant something different. Okay, so. Follow label directions. In my opinion, today, for bovine respiratory disease, there is no need or excuse for using an off-label antibiotic. Especially genomycin. I hope I'm preaching to the choir in this room. Absolutely no reason or justification for putting genomycin into beef cattle for respiratory disease or neomycin. We've got residue issues with those drugs. We've got safety issues. With today's drugs, pick from the labeled ones. You're protected by a lot of research. You're protected by scientifically defined withdrawal time. There's a four-step set of thinking for extra-label use in cattle. The first one is, if there's something labeled for that application and it works, use it. You're protected by the label. You have a withdrawal time that applies. There's a lot of science behind it. Number two, if the labeled drug does not work, then the requirement is that a veterinarian be involved and that the first step is extra label use of a food animal labeled drug. And an exaggerated withdrawal time has to be applied by the veterinarian. Number three, If the food animal drug, if there's no food animal drug that can be used in an extra label manner, then a non-food animal veterinary or a human label drug may be used in an extra label manner. This is a giant step. Make sure you and your veterinarian are very clear about the need for it, and you're very, very clear about the withdrawal time and exactly when it will be used. It requires a lot of planning. And the fourth one is a compounded drug. Only then, when none of the other is available, can you get to a compounded drug. We've gone through periods of having some compounded drugs available. I hope we're getting over that. Only in very specific cases should those be used or applied, and you need to sit down and have a real think tank with your veterinarian on what you're going to do with them. Be aware that a compounded drug is way different than a generic drug. A labeled generic drug has gone through FDA approval and is manufactured in FDA facilities. A compounded drug from a pharmacist or a veterinarian has not gone through that approval process, and you have no guarantee of safety or efficacy of that drug. Make sure of what you're buying. The very last thing I wanted to do is I wanted to pick a disease that you may or may not be familiar with as beef producers. What is wrong with this animal? Notice that left rear, how it's standing. It's weight-bearing a little bit, and this disease came into a feedlot, started in two pens, and by about 3 months, we had 300 cases out of 15,000 head, and it spread to every pen in the lot. Here's a close-up of between the claws of that foot. I'll give you four options of what it is. Number one is super foot rot with the new hyper-resistant, hyper-invasive, necrotizing Fusobacterium necrophorum. That just sounds like it ought to be it. Hairy heel wart, which is treponema, commonly seen in dairy cows. Conventional foot rot in a chronically wet environment. BVD lesions with secondary bacterial infection. Okay, now everyone needs to vote. Those who win, report to the back for a free year-old open keg of Natty Light and a package of hardtack. Kind of on a budget here. How many of you think it's the super foot rot with the hyper-resistant, hyper-whatever? Okay, not going to be able to sell you anything. Hairy heel wart. Okay, got a few. Conventional foot rot in a chronically wet environment. Okay, thanks for chiming in. BVD lesions with secondary bacterial infection. This is actually hairy heel wart. And why I wanted to bring this up to you today was this was an outbreak of hairy heel wart in all colored cattle in a beef feedlot. And as you, those of you in Iowa, Illinois, may see a few more of these. I'm familiar with some smaller yards up there. This one was down on the high plains. Those cattle have this characteristic stance of standing on their toes rather than completely non-weight-bearing like a typical foot rot. This is what the heel will look like, erosion clear across the heel. That's the coronary band looking from the back of the foot. Here's another shot. Very, very erosive. Starts up there in the heels. This is the classic strawberry foot rot, it's called, lesion that occurs early. And you see those long hairs sticking up? That's why it's called hairy heel wart, because you get some growth from those. You may see it like that. You may see it like the others. And there's what it does in between the toes. It'll go clear up front. So if you know you routinely pull and treat your own foot rots, but the thing that brought the veterinarians in on this one was what we're using for foot rots isn't working anymore. So just something I thought you might enjoy seeing to keep an eye out for. And we've got, by my watch, like a minute or so or two for questions or rebuttals or throwing things. What did we treat, the hairy heel wart? They're all off-label right now. There's a couple long-acting antibiotics that will work. What brings it up is that the tetracyclines typically will not work on them. So you end up looking at, there's a couple long-actings that can work. I could give you the names. I don't want to put them out because it really needs to be with your veterinarian. They're off-label, but there are a couple things that can work. The other thing some people have done for that is they've had to resort to foot baths. That's what they do in the dairies, and they've actually had to pull pins out and run them through it. It's something you need to see very early and get it shut down in that pen before it spreads. Frustrating.
This has been a production of Angus Productions Incorporated, the industry's information leader.